capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to this week's Level Talk program. My name's John Harrison. Now, when I studied in China a long time ago, from 1982 to 1985, I do remember the world's press being highly critical, even at that time, of China's developments. Perhaps it was the way that China adopted Western business practices in a way that we in the West perceived as not playing by the rules or basically undercutting Western markets. In today's world, that accusation continues to be a major issue, but so is the fact that China has become too powerful for many, and she has now actually been recognized as a superpower. But China's success is based on her economy. And how solid is China's economy in actual fact? That's what we're going to be talking about today. Joining me on this program to talk about these issues is Michele Geraci, the head of China Economic Policy Program, assistant professor in finance at the Nottingham University Business School in China, and Pauline Leung, who is managing director of the Hong Kong-based research consultancy Asia Analytica. She has earned an outstanding reputation as among the best informed analysts of Chinese political economy and authors the well-known Leung on China newsletter. Welcome, both of you, the program.
Thank you.
Now, let's start with the good news. The IMF has just awarded China with recognizing that the yuan is a reserve currency. Now, this might be a largely symbolic gesture, but nevertheless, it does recognize China's economic might. Now, what does this mean? Dr. Geraci, would you like to start, please?
Like, as you said, it is mostly a symbolic recognition. It does change, in my view, almost nothing in practice, basically because, let's not forget, no one really uses SDR, and it has been used only in a very few occasions, and the overall amount of outstanding value is about $300 billion.
Yeah.
If we recall, every day, foreign exchange currency trading value is $5 trillion.
Right.
So the $300 billion is equivalent to a 90 minutes of trading of worldwide currency, basically the equivalent of a football match in the whole grand scheme of international currency. So basically, it doesn't really matter. Now, the renminbi is 10%, 10 point something percent, 11% of that. So we're talking $30 billion, which is really nothing compared to what the size of the Chinese economy is and what the demand for foreign currency is in international markets. So really symbolic thing, and we can discuss this later, but I don't think it does change anything for the Chinese economy. I don't think it will change the demand for renminbi, and I don't think it is any step forward to make the renminbi any more of a reserve currency than it was last week.
So this is just basically PR, is that right, Pauline?
Well, it's not so much PR, it's a vanity thing.
Yeah.
But China has arrived, and it is now part of the international basket. But more important, I think, is that it's not just an empty symbolism. This is the first step of China entering the international markets. And if next Chinese stocks are listed, are included in MSCI indexes,
right,
then that is going to be very important. So it is symbolic, but it is not totally empty. It means China is now joining the international world, the international market. So it doesn't mean much for the currency itself in terms of day trading, but it does say that China is arriving.
Okay.
Also not yet arrived, I would say.
Okay. Now, there seems to be a sort of disconnect then between what you've just said and the general sentiment of what I read in the newspapers in the West, you know, the mainstream news sources at least, which are, generally speaking, fairly critical of China's economic policies. I mean, one of the biggest sort of bones of discontent that people are always going on about is that China's economic success is largely built on a huge housing bubble. Now, this to me is extremely simplistic, but I'd like to ask you as experts to please, you know, clarify this. Dr. Geraci, is China's success largely built on a huge housing bubble?
No, I don't think that statement is a fair representation of the status of the Chinese economy. I would perhaps modify by saying The Chinese success has been based on a large proportion of investment. To make it simple, the Chinese economy is 50% investment, 50% consumption,
yeah,
and a little bit of net exports, much less than what people think.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, let's not forget that China over the last 40 years has shown the world that a country the size of 1.3, 1.4 billion people can grow at roughly 10% per year for 40 years, which is an extraordinary performance. We know the results in terms of lifting 300, 400 million out of poverty.
Yeah.
Things are stable. Now, if things were to break now, you know what? It almost doesn't matter, because for 40 years, Chinese people have enjoyed increasing quality of life and standard of living. So there has been a success. It's a little bit like when the Chinese criticized the European Eurozone crisis, Greece, Germany, Deutsche Bank stuff. And I say, you know what? We have enjoyed a prosperous life for 70 years, 70. So if now we have a glitch for 5, 10 years, doesn't matter. We will readjust the model. In China, I think we will readjust the model if a crisis were to come.
Okay, that's very interesting. You're talking about sort of very sort of internal, inside China view on things and how it'll affect us in China and Chinese. But, you know, a lot of people in the West are saying that in the past, the old joke was, you know, when America gets a cough, has a cough, the rest of the world has pneumonia, and now they're replaced with China. You know, if China catches a cold, we all die, you know. I mean, a lot of people in the West now are criticizing Chinese, the government, for kind of being irresponsible and blaming the Chinese government on not clamping down on bad debts and not clamping down on a runaway housing market and so on, being irresponsible, and that could lead to a huge economic crash in China, a hard landing, which would very much affect the rest of the world in economic terms. Do you think about that at all, Dr. Garacci? And then I'd like to ask you, Pauline Leung, the same question.
I do, yes, indeed. If China were to have a crisis, of course, there would be a cough that would impact the whole world.
Yeah.
However, the advantage that China has is that it is not a market economy, let's say. It is a state-owned China Inc. enterprises. So the government has all the lever to pull in the direction that it wishes, with very little question asked and very quick decision time.
Yes.
Now, irresponsible policy, in a way, it is Europe and maybe the U.S. that need to look at their own house, because we have had a zero interest policy for several years.
Right.
And we do not know what the effect of this bubble in asset prices in the West could be, because we never had an anti-Q3 measure. We only do Q1, Q2, Q3. But we never undo them. And, you know, both Mario Draghi, my Italian compatriot, and Yellen in the U.S., they are doing very, in a way, irresponsible policies. China keeps rates relatively high. We're talking about 3%. They've been at 4 or 5% for the last 40 years. And we should be careful before criticizing China on monetary policy specifically, because it is the West that needs to first look at its own house. Having said that, I agree with you. If China were to collapse, it would be a big problem for the world, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Pauline, would you like to comment on those, on my question, which was actually rather complicated as I was talking about possible housing crash in China and then the effect of a major Chinese economic collapse on the rest of the world? Your comment, please.
Let me go back a bit about all the comments on the Chinese economy.
Yep.
How Chinese policymakers are getting it right, getting it wrong, and so forth. The trouble with all that is that they all tend to be sound bites, you know, making a nice, neat little newspaper headline.
Yeah.
And most of them would have a gem of truth in them. My problem with all this is that I think all these criticisms are missing the real point. They are distractions. The real problem, from my point of view, the real problem with the Chinese economy is systemic.
Yes.
The nation still operates with the systems and governing framework created for a bygone era when peasants still predominated and the state planners were still a powerful force.
Mm-hmm.
China is now moving into the 21st century. It's moving into international markets. And yet its systems are still from those old days. And it's trying to patch it up a bit here and a bit there. That's where the basic problem lies with the Chinese economy.
Okay, fascinating what you've just said, and I'd like to talk to more detail about that. I want to talk about the banking crisis, but what you just said is so interesting. I'd like to talk about the bank crisis a bit later on. But as China now engages in the world's international financial systems, surely you see China sees faults in the international financial system. And one of the faults, one of the underlying faults at the moment that we're all experiencing, the West, is that private enterprise on itself does not seem to be able to handle some of the structural problems that we're coming up against. And I'm talking about environmental problems, and I'm also talking about economic problems that can only be handled when people come together. And China's economic system, to me, and okay, I'm not an expert, its characteristics, one thing is called state capitalism. Now, could, in fact, looking at the other way completely, I'm playing the devil's advocate here, Pauline, that China's economic system could actually be more sustainable than many of the Western models that we see at the moment?
I think that we are talking about two strands here.
Yep.
One is the political model where you can make policies without having to go through 10 referendums and have the public say something quite opposite to what you were expecting.
Yeah.
You know, China can turn around its policies in a few weeks, just like that. So we're talking about that. But what I'm talking about are things like the talents and the rules and regulations and the governing framework for the effective management of a modern economy.
Okay.
China's non-performing bankers and borrowers are really just manifestations of a more basic dysfunction.
Okay.
And that's where I go on to talk about, you know, how the system isn't meeting the 21st century.
Okay. Let's carry on with that discussion after a short break.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Programme. My name's John Harrison. Today we're talking about the real state of China's economy. Mikhail Gerachi, the head of China Economic Policy Programme, Assistant Professor in Finance at the Nottingham University Business School in China, and Pauline Leung, who is Managing Director of the Hong Kong-based research consultancy Asia Analytica. Now, we're just touching on some very interesting themes in the beginning of the programme. Dr. Gerachi, do you think that China's basic economic model is, as Pauline Leung says, out of touch with today's world, and it cannot really function in a modern world?
I, in a way, agree and disagree at the same time. It is indeed a system which is not in touch with the modern world,
mm-hmm.
but it is the best system for China because China lives in a different era. And so China, a level of development is not comparable to what we have in other parts of the world. So China, yes, does behave like an 1800th century economy,
yeah.
And that's where it is now. It is an economy. Remember, you know, we have a low GDP per capita for the population. We have an environmental problem. We have income disparity. We have the socio-economic, political situation. It is like a country that lives a century earlier.
Yeah.
And so for where China is now, the system that it has, obsolete for the West, is, in a way, probably the best for China in its historical moment.
Okay, well, Pauline Leung, I mean, that's quite a controversial thing that Dr. Gerachi has just said, isn't it? It threatens what you just said. Could you possibly agree with Dr. Gerachi, or would you like to insist on the fact that China has got to update its financial and management administrative systems to communicate better with the rest of the world?
I will narrow it down to something much simpler. Let's take data and statistics. You cannot have effective policy making without proper data and proper information.
Yeah.
And yet the world's second biggest economy does not have the capacity to monitor financial transactions of its local governments with any accuracy
mm-hmm.
and in real time. This means policymakers have been coming up with strategies to handle banks' exposure to local government bad debt, having to guesstimate rather than actually knowing the true extent of the surge in local government borrowing.
Yep.
it needed to send out hundreds of thousands of people throughout the various provinces just to find out who owes what to whom.
Right.
This is not helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dr. Geraci, there is a situation there, isn't there? Because we have a huge amount of loans growing from what's called shadow banks, that is, banks which are sort of semi-official, but not really there, you know. And this has sort of been growing quite dramatically over by more than 30% annually over the last 3 years. I mean, in theory, shadow banks diversify sources of credit and spread risk away from the regular banks. But in practice, the lines between the shadow and formal banking systems are kind of blurred. What do you think? I mean, is this banking situation sustainable? Is it going to lead to an almighty banking crash, the likes of which we've never seen before?
The banking and the non-performing loans and the size of the debt is a big worry for China. I agree. We are looking at in excess of 300% of the GDP, debt-to-GDP ratio. If we include
really? That
private
much?
Public, that number includes private, public, corporate, financial, non-financial, and government debt.
Yeah.
While maybe we tend to only look at, for example, the Italian 140%, the Germany 80%. That would only be the government portion of the debt. I'm talking about the whole thing. In a way, same size as Greece, same size as Italy, same size as France. So high level, very dangerous. Shadow banking is a problem, although it does, in a way, play an important function because it sets what should be a real market rate, which is probably even higher than what the central bank sets now. Now, how do governments solve banking crises? They solve it in three ways. Either they default, two, they have high inflation, and they do not default technically, but the value of what they return to investors is lower in real terms. Three, the exchange rate goes down, so foreign investors lose out. Now, China, you know, critical as the situation may be in the debt, has all these three levers they can play, including the infinite ink that they have in the government to print any amount of money that is needed to rescue banks. And of course, when countries deleverage, they don't really deleverage. They just transfer the debt from one component to the other component of the society. So if Chinese banks, which are, you know, the big ones, all state-owned, were to fail, the government prints money, rescues them, recapitalizes them. The money in circulation grows, and to some extent, inflation may grow, and the citizens pay a little bit of a price. So, in a way, China also has the advantage to let, as it did happen in the U.S., select which banks goes down. During the Fed crisis in 2008, you know, people were lined up. Goldman Sachs, no, Bear down. Merrill Lynch, yes, no, Bank of America comes to save. Royal Bank of Scotland, Northern Rock, was the first one. So it was kind of resaved. So in a way, China has this advantage. They can let a few banks go down to send a signal, like it happens now with some of these wealth management product trust company that do default. We are witnessing now growing debt default, even by state-owned companies. So I agree, there is a problem, but it's being managed.
Okay. Pauline Long, I mean, in a way, if China was to adopt so-called, in quotes, normal way of managing its economy and its banking system, would it not just sort of seize up, you know, within about 2 weeks or something, and nothing would happen? It would completely collapse. Is it actually realistic to expect China to be able to adopt that? I'm looking at it from distance. Okay, I'm sitting in a recording studio in Edinburgh. It's all very well for me to cast judgment like this, and you're sitting in Hong Kong, and you're right there. I'd like to hear what you think about that, please.
Well, to start with, I think there's nothing quite normal about anything in China, normal in the way that the West would understand it. I mean, a very obvious thing with banking, there is something called relationship lending, policy lending, and that is very, very important in China, how banks lend. So that alone throws a spanner in the works with, you know, all the typical models and answers that academics come up with in the West. One thing, for instance, the close ties between the property sector and bank loans, it could set the dominoes falling. I think the latest numbers I have is that all bank loans secured on property as at the end of last year make up 40% of total loans. So if the property market goes, you know, funny, all the banks are up for 40% of their loans. So China cannot, to me, in my view, cannot be explained and looked at through the conventional Western approach to banking, because Western banks are very different.
Yeah.
They don't have relationship and policy lending.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the program, and I guess I haven't really asked you the major sort of question that this program's all about. I mean, how serious is this? I mean, as I said, I've been a China watcher for most of my life now. I'm an old man, and China's always received bad press. It's always been on the verge of collapse. It's always been this, like, China's fault, you know. Never mind our own economic faults and our bad judgments and the way that we're now encouraging racism and so on as the end of the world's problems. It's always China's fault. But ask you directly, what is the likelihood now in the next, say, 12-month period of China having a really hard landing, a big bump, and that's going to not only spell the end of Chinese development for a good few years, but also it's going to set the West back hugely? Dr. Geraci, your answer to that question, please.
Very little, pretty much zero. As much as one can say zero, I would say almost irrelevant probability that would happen within the next, end of 17, yes.
Okay, good. I'm expecting a different answer from you, Pauline Lung. What is your verdict?
Oh, no, I totally agree with Dr. Geraci.
Right.
Over the next 12 months, I do not see a sort of a drastic crisis in the Chinese economy. But I must take your comment about the media, going all negative on China.
Yeah.
This is only the past couple of years. If you've lived long enough, and I have, you will remember how China was this wonderful miracle maker that has double-digit growth every year,
mm-hmm.
and how people were saying that's the new horizon. Imagine 2.6 billion feet to sell shoes to.
Yeah.
So this negative perception of China, I think, is a reaction from that rosy view from the earlier days.
Yeah.
People swing to two extremes.
I know that there definitely were more positive press reviews and reactions to China's development than the present, but I do remember also at the same time, parallel to those stories you've just been talking about, a continual negative reaction towards Chinese economic success because it was closing American factories, because it was all of our labour has been outsourced to China and this, that and the other. And of course, people didn't mention that actually a lot of the factories which were constructed in China were constructed using Western money, so that Western companies were still generating profit and a lot more profit by outsourcing to China than before.
Well, let me interrupt you there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when Americans were saying that about the Japanese.
Yeah.
So being blaming events, people and things in other countries for domestic problems,
yeah.
I do not take that seriously because I don't think it's new. It's just human nature.
You don't, but if you lived in the States right now, in some of the southern states of the States perhaps, with the American elections coming up, I mean, blaming China is a big business, isn't it, Dr. Geraci? I mean, Trump's like a field day for Trump, China.
Well, of course, both Trump and Hillary,
yeah.
Now they're busy talking to their electorate. Let's not forget that Clinton, during her tenure as secretary and other position, has been very against China and especially on the issue of renminbi.
Absolutely.
So now, of course, Trump comes up with the idea and he repeats what she has kind of been doing.
Yeah.
And that's what Trump accuses Clinton about. So, between those two, I think they will, for different reasons, both against China, and in either way, neither is good news for China relationship with the U.S. But they're practical people. Whoever gets elected
right.
will be given the red carpet next time they come to Beijing.
Sure. But just let's kind of sum up in a moment, please. I'd like to ask both of you now for your resume. How serious a condition is the Chinese economy in, if it's in a serious condition at all? Pauline Lung, please.
I think it is serious in the sense that the Chinese government needs to do something about the fact that its institutions, its systems are not coming up to its modern economy, are not meeting the needs of its modern economy.
Yeah.
That is separate from politics, which sometimes people confuse, because to say that China should change its systems, there is an implication there that it's a political system. I'm talking strictly about bureaucracies, about bankruptcy laws and the such. In that sense, yes, it's very serious.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Karachi?
Very briefly, like I always tell my friends, I say if China was a country that operated like a Western country, like a market economy, then yes, the situation would be very serious. But because it is not, mm-hmm. it is a planned economy, I almost say, venture to say 100%, everything that works and works in China is a planned economy, then yes, the situation is bad, it has problems, but the government has the tool to manage it. So the market will not make it crash.
Thank you very much. It's been fascinating talking to both of you. I really feel that you understand this situation. You can really speak from, you know, the inside out. And I think I can speak for all listeners. We really appreciate your input today on this program. Thank you very much indeed. Michel Garacci, the head of China Economic Policy Program, assistant professor in finance at the Nottingham University Business School in China, and Pauline Leung, managing director of the Hong Kong-based research consultancy Asia Analytica. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. Goodbye.